Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm glad everybody's here. I think this day is going to be an exciting day for us, not just here in this setting, because we're going to be looking at prophecy, but also for Pastor Jeff. I'm really excited about this study that he's going to do. I think it's badly needed. I know a lot of people are asking me questions, and I know a lot of people are asking him questions as well. So I'm excited to do that. I'm excited to hear his thoughts in the sermon. And I would just tell you that you need to pray for him, because he will be on a target for a lot of people, because he's saying what Satan does not want us to know. And so just be aware that he's taken a risk, because he believes God has called him to do this now. And I think he's right, and it's the right time to do it. And I'm just praying for that to be a wonderful time. This is kind of our study outline, the calendar moving forward. Somebody asked that earlier, but we'll do, the book of Joel is only three chapters long. We'll do that, and we'll finish it on the 16th. Possibly we'll be on campus the 16th, but I'll let you know that. Later this week, they're going to finalize some things, and I should be able to make that clarification this week. And then, as I mentioned before, Carol will be subbing for me for 4 weeks in September. So we appreciate that. I did send out a note on the Sight and Sound trip, Queen Esther. I haven't tabulated the results yet. Some of you have sent them back. My guess is the sense is going to be to postpone the trip until next year. But I want to get all of them back and look at it and see what people want to do. We've got full capability to get our money back, so that's not a problem with that. We just have to decide what's best for everybody to do. Okay, so let's, I can find my cursor, here we go. Let's get started. So I wanted to do something complimentary to what the pastor was doing, because I don't want to step on anything he's going to cover. And today he's going to cover signs of the times. And that's pretty critical, because that's a wonderful way to start the whole discussion about prophecy. Many people are familiar with prophecy. Many people are not. Many people don't want to be familiar with it. And so he's got to be careful in how he approaches this. And I'm real excited to hear him do that today. But we're going to do the book of Joel. And the book of Joel is an interesting little book. And my guess is, if I could see all of you now, I would ask you how many have studied this or heard sermons or had Bible studies on it. And the number would be pretty low. There's one or two verses that are always quoted in Joel, but they don't really give you a sense of the book. And like Amos, this book is a powerful book for us today. And it's a short book. But it does speak very plainly about a couple of things that I think are important for us to understand. So let's talk a little bit about it. Let's talk about when it was written, first of all. So the whole idea of this book is Joel got a word from the Lord, and he was passing this word along to the people of Israel. And unlike so many of these books who say this was in, you know, the time of King Hezekiah or whatever, this book has none of that in it. So there's no easy way to date this book by the comments that are in it. Now, this doesn't affect its quality, because its quality is timeless and its context is timeless. But it's interesting to figure out about when scholars think it was written. And so one of the ways we look at this is by things mentioned in the book, you know, again, during the reign of, or, you know, during the time of, or after the time we were hauled off to Babylon or whatever. Those things give us some clues. But the other thing that gives us clues is what's not in this book. And that's the way people have come to pick a date for it, by what's not in it. Joel writes to, I'm going to admit, Linda Stewart is coming in. So let me just take a second and admit her in. Linda, thanks for joining. I know you have gotten in, and hopefully you can see what we're doing now. We just started. So again, you can only date this book by some very sketchy things. And it doesn't mention anything about a divided kingdom. It deals with Israel as a whole. So the first thought is it happened before Israel was divided. So when the nation of Israel, Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom were together, that gives us one way to date it. The other way to date it is it doesn't mention any king at all in the book. And there's only two periods of time. Well, they don't have a king today, but in ancient Israel, there was only two periods of time when there was no kings. One was before the first king, when Saul was named king. And there's a short period of time when there are no kings in Israel. And you can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 11. Let me just give you the headline on that and that thing. There was a king named Ahaziah, and he dies. His mother is the kind of like the queen mother, and she's Queen Athaliah. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing all these correct. But she wants to be queen of the land. So what does she do? She murders all of the royal family. She has them all killed, all of his heirs, except one. One infant was born, and that infant is named Joash. And the queen's sister and the high priest hide him away in the temple and keep him for 7 years. And in Israel, you could be a king when you were 7 years old. So 7 years pass, there is no king. There's this queen who is ruling Israel. And at the seven-year period, the high priest brings this young king, Joash, out and anoints him king. The queen is furious, but the people rise up against her and kill her because now they understand what she's done. And so Joash becomes a seven-year-old king of Israel. So most scholars have a pretty good idea that this book was probably written in that seven-year period, or that period when she was queen and there was no king and before the two lands split up. So go back if you want to read that. That's an interesting story, but fairly short. Go back into 2 Kings chapter 11 and you can read all about that. One of the other things prophecy books teach us is as we put them in context, we can kind of see what's going on in Israel and some of the things that are spoken of in the prophets then become clearer to us. So who is this guy Joel? There are a number of people called Joel in the Old Testament and New Testament. And other than the one mention in the New Testament of this book, this prophecy, and this book of Joel, we don't know much about him at all. We think he lived in the land of Judah, where the two tribes are, and he was a resident of Jerusalem. And that's all of that's conjecture, by the way, but that's the best thinking for most of the people that do interpretation. So other than who his father is, we don't know much about him. So the word Joel, or Joel, is a Hebrew word, and it means Jehovah is God. So Joel is Jehovah, El is God, so Jehovah is God. We see a lot of Hebrew names are related to that. Anything that has an El in it, El, has something to do with God. So his father's name is Pethuel. Now, we don't know much about Pethuel. We know less about Pethuel than we do about Joel. The only thing we know is his father's name means the mouthpiece for God or the persuader of God. And I just want to stop here for a second and bring a little bit of thought to this. You know, one of the things as parents and grandparents we have is a responsibility to share with our children. So the only thing we know about Joel and Pethuel is Pethuel was a persuader of God. So Pethuel had told Joel all about God, and Joel now becomes a prophet of God, and his name means, Jehovah is God. So we do see a pretty powerful influence of names in the Old Testament because they were so important. But that is only a shadow of the power that fathers, mothers, grandmothers, grandfathers, aunts and uncles have on children in a family. We just need to make a note of that as we go through, because it's such a powerful thing. So this book, what about it is interesting? What's it about? What's its style? What type of book is it? Well, the book is about three prophecies of Joel. And by this prophecy, we get introduced to one of the ways prophecy is understood in the New Testament. It's called the mountain peak, or two mountains, or three mountains, or however. There's many, many ways to talk about it. But if you've ever been in the Old West and you've been driving and you look out the windshield and you see mountains in the distance, you see one mountain and you focus on that and you drive towards it. But when you get there, when you get close, suddenly you discover that it's not one mountain. There's probably another mountain behind it, and perhaps even a bigger one behind that. And that is called the mountain theory of prophecy. When you see something that's a prophecy, and you move towards it, the closer you get to it, the more you see it relates to something in addition to what you first saw. And so we'll see some of that in the book of Joel. He relates an immediate problem for Israel, and that is a swarm of locusts. Then he relates that to something that is what we would call an imminent problem, which is coming in chapter 2, and then the ultimate problem in chapter 3. So we're going to see this prophecy style play out in these three chapters of the book. Now, the style of this book is metaphoric. In other words, this is a book where you can read it, and you do get a surface reading for what he's talking about, but the real power of this book comes in the symbols and what it tells us for later, much like the book of Amos. It relates to us today, but it's powerful. And the things he talks about are signs for things to come. And we'll get a look at that. One of the commentators that I use, you don't find very many, by the way, on the book of Joel. But one of them is a commentator that some of you know about. His name is Warren Wiersbe. And I have his Old Testament and New Testament commentaries, and he's faithful to commentate on all of these things. And one of the things he says is he looks at Joel as headlines in a newspaper. He's screaming headlines. Locusts invade the land. Nation faces severe economic crisis. No end to the drought in sight. And if you could picture the headlines of a newspaper, that's if you were looking at the the Jerusalem Post of the day, that would be what the headlines are. And that sort of sets the stage for what we want to look at in Joel. And let's start, this is what I've talked about the outline of the book of Joel: immediate, imminent, and ultimate. And I'll explain those as we get a little further into it. So let's turn to the book of Joel. It's the book right before Amos, so you should be able to find it without a lot of problems, small book. And it starts with Joel authenticating who he is. He says, the word of the Lord, again, the word of the Lord. So Jesus, the word, the spoken word of the Lord is Jehovah. The spoken word of God comes to Joel, son of Pethuel. And so what he's going to relay in this book is not his words, but it's the word of the Lord. He's basically saying, I've been talked to by the Lord, and he's told me what to come say to you, and I'm going to say this to you, so listen up. So he says, the word of the Lord that came to Joel, son of Pethuel. And then he says, verse 2, hear this, you elders. Now it's important to understand who he's speaking to here. So elders is one. Now elders can mean a number of things, and I think probably in this case it means all of them. Elders can be people that are aged in the community. And we have many cultures, Hebrew culture is one of them, where elders are revered. And they're looked upon favorably, and they're they're consulted, they're asked their opinion, they're sought out for advice. That's probably not so much today. You know, if we watch the modern commercials on television, the elders are, you know, looked upon as buffoons. They don't know anything. They're not hip to what's going on. They have to go to their kids. Now, you know, as a practical matter, most of you know, if you can't figure out your TV, you go to your grandson or granddaughter and they can just do it automatically, or your phone or your iPad. So we do know there's some truth in that statement. But what we miss today is the fact that people don't talk any longer to one another, to their elders, and they don't get wisdom. And see, he says, hear this, you elders. Listen, all who live in the land. So not just the elders, but all who are there. But he's got a role for the elders. He says, has anything like this ever happened in your days or in the days of your ancestors? Now, this brings to mind a couple of things. One is, you know, oral traditions in cultures are important. Tribal situations, even in America, you know, the oral traditions that we have, which is our history, our heroes, our villains, our great events that happened in our history, are all important to understand because they are the things that make us who we are as a people, as a nation, as a culture. And of course, one of the sad things that's happening today is people that are anti-American are really trying to dislodge us from the anchors that are our faith, anchors that are our history, anchors that are our heroes, anchors that are the admire people that we admire so much today in the world. And so today, I think elders can be related to us. I mean, I think it's to the people like us who have been around for a while. It can also mean leaders, like the leaders of a church, leaders of a nation. The term elder has a particular spiritual connotation, is one who is spiritually mature. And I think all of this probably plays into the discussion that Joel is having here. He says, hear this, you elders. Listen, you know, has anything like this ever happened? Has anybody ever told you about this? Is this part of your older, you know, oral tradition? Well, it wasn't. And then he goes on to say, tell it to your children and let your children tell it to their children and their children to the next generation. So we know in Israeli history, all of the feasts and festivals come out of an event, Passover, the event of Passover, the event of the death angel, the event of the unleavened bread, the event of the first fruits, the event of Pentecost. All of those are things that happened that are memorialized in feasts and in celebrations by Jews and told to their children. You know, if you go through a Seder at Passover, you see the history of Passover. You see a lot of future things in that as well, which is profound. But we should tell that to our children. We shouldn't leave it to the schools. I mean, the schools are great to do that, hopefully. But we should also do it. We should also tell our children and our grandchildren what's important. They should hear from us the history that's important. I'm going to go back a few years now. But when I used to work for IBM, I had a job in K through 12. And I had to develop programs and things for the middle and high school. One of the clients I worked with was National Geographic. And I loved working with them because they and Smithsonian have a view that is a long view. And one of the things they were doing, which I was greatly excited about, was they were doing audio recordings of voices in Appalachia. They were going into Appalachia and talking to the elders. They were asking them about how they grew up, what they did, how they got water, how they built their houses, how they did their fences, where they got their food. And all of this was an oral tradition which they were going to preserve for history so that people could go back. You know, we lose a sense of history as we move forward. People could go back and look at this and be connected with our past. I'd love to go hear some of those and see if they've done anything with it, you know, finally where it got to. But now we're in the point of the World War II generation. We're trying to understand, and they've written books, and we've written and read books about World War II and the wars and the heroes and the battles and all the things that demonstrate the characteristics of our country and our people. And those things are powerful, and we need to continue them. And what Joel is telling these people is, this event that's happening now is powerful. You need to relate it to your children, not just because of what it is, but because of the lessons you learn will help you in later life, help them in later life. We'll see that as we get in. So chapter 1, verses 4 through 6. If you read in your translation, you will see probably different terms for locusts here. You'll see palmer worm, or you'll see something else. But understand that a locust to us is a grasshopper. And there are 50 or 60 or even more varieties of them in the Middle East. And what the prophet speaks to here is the mix of species. So he says, what the locust swarm has left, the great locusts have eaten. So let me stop there. If you've read the news in the last 6 months, you've seen that there's a locust swarm that began in Egypt. Actually, I think it began over in Sudan or somewhere over in there, and moved to Egypt, and then moved across Israel into Jordan, and even today is in Italy, which is kind of scary because of the things that can happen there. But there are hundreds of millions of these insects, and when they fly, they darken the sky. You cannot see, and they cover 5 or 10 square miles, and they just move through the land like an unstoppable army. And they eat everything in sight. So what the swarm has left, the great locusts have eaten. So the swarm is a mix. And the great locusts are the ones that are a little bigger, and they fly a little slower, and they come in second, and they eat everything that's left that the locust swarm didn't eat. And then what they have left, the young locusts have eaten. These are the ones that eat down to the bark, eat everything down to the ground. And it says, what the young locusts have left, other locusts have eaten. And let me just say, these are all different stages of locusts. There are caterpillars, there are larvae, there are all different things covered in these. And you'll see those if you look in other translations, because the words, they're not really clear exactly what they mean. And so every translation has done them a little different. But what you just need to understand is, there's a mix of locusts. And when they come through in waves. And what one wave doesn't eat, the next one gets. And what they leave, the next one gets. And what the last one does is eat everything else that's left. And so he's talking about locust swarms. And we know they come every generation or so into the Middle East. One has just come. It's kind of interesting that it flew across Israel and did almost no damage to Israel. And then landed in Jordan and did damage in Jordan. They roost at night, and they fly during the day, and they eat in the afternoon. And they can cover 1,500 miles. So they're like an army in that respect. They rest at night and they travel during the day. He makes an allusion to armies as we get further. So he's now spoken to the elders. He's spoken to all that live in the land. And he's implored them to teach this to their children. Now he addresses another group of people. Verse 5, wake up, you drunkards, and weep. Now, let me say, he's speaking to drunkards, but drunkards here is a metaphor for a whole class of people, and I'll talk about that as we get a little further into it. Wake up. In other words, you know, you're in a stupor because of what you've been drinking. Wake up and start crying. Why? Wail, all you drinkers of wine, because the new wine has been snatched from your lips. Anybody that's ever worked around an alcoholic, or a drug addict, or somebody that is a pornography addict, or any other kind of addict, the immediate solution is to take away what they have. A drunkard can't drink if there's no alcohol. You take that away, and it'll be a rough period of time, but that's one of the ways to get through the argument or get through the discussion. And he's saying, wake up and weep, because the wine that you've been drinking has been snatched from your lips. It's been taken away. He talks about new wine. So there may be some that's still in jugs and bottles, but the new wine is gone. And we'll see a little bit about that next. He now says, a nation has invaded my land. And he's actually speaking of the locusts here, but he likens them to a nation. And this is setting the stage for what he's going to say in chapter 2. A nation has invaded my land, a mighty army without number. So again, relate this to locusts. You can't number them. There's millions of them. And they've come and they go over the fences, they go over everything, and they just eat everything in their path. And they say it has the teeth of a lion and the fangs of a lioness. Now, that's a metaphor also. And what it really just is saying is that if you know the way a lion or a lioness operates, they're deadly. They pursue their prey. And when they go after it, they get it. And when they get it, they kill it. And they totally destroy it by eating it. And that's really the picture he's painting here. This army, this number, this mighty army, acts like a lion. It completely catches, completely eats, completely destroys its prey. And then he says, it's laid waste my vines. So Israel was a land of vines. They had a lot of vines. They had fig trees. They had, olive trees. They had all kinds of things. If you've been there recently, you know it's a land of milk and honey. But in this case, they've laid waste to the vine and they've ruined the fig trees. Why? Because they've eaten everything. They've eaten the leaves, they've eaten the fruit, they've eaten the twigs. And it even says in verse 7, they have stripped off the bark, thrown it away, leaving their branches white. You know, there's, and I can't remember the name of the bug now, but there's a bug now that gets into plants, and they will take a young tree and they'll eat a strip around it and make it white, and because they'll strip the bark off. And when they do that, the tree dies because that's the way the nutrient comes up. So in this case, what you've got to understand is these locusts have stripped, they've not only eaten everything on the tree, but they've stripped all the bark off the tree, leaving the branches white. So the tree is alive for the moment, but it's dying. There's nothing that can be done to save it. And that's the condition that all of the land is after these locusts have come. And now he's saying, what do you do about it? Well, he gives us an example here. Mourn like a virgin in sackcloth. Virgin here means a young maiden. Mourn like a young maiden in sackcloth, grieving for the betrothed of her youth. So picture a young woman who gets married, and she just gets married and her husband dies. So that's the picture here. Mourn like that young bride. It's sackcloth is a goat's hair weaving, and it was a coarse fabric, and it was made so that you wore it and you felt the presence of just grief, and you could mourn, and sackcloth and ashes were a way that you mourned and grieved. And he says, grain offerings and drink offerings are cut off from the house of the Lord. So not only is the food gone, but all of the sacrifices that the people would bring to the house of the Lord are gone. So the grain offerings and the drink offerings are cut off. So there's no longer a way for them to worship through that form of offering. And the priests, because of that, are in mourning. And those who minister before the Lord are in mourning because there is no longer sacrifice. There's no longer the way for them to glorify and honor God. And again, this speaks to the completeness of the destruction. It says the fields are ruined. The ground is dried up. So there's also a drought that happens to be going on at this time. So not only have the locusts eaten everything, not only are all the bushes and trees destroyed, but the seeds are gone. The ground is dried up. The grain is destroyed. The new wine is dried up. The olive oil fails. So everything that they have to live by, to drink, to use as medicine, the olive oil, to use for cooking, all of that is gone. And because the grain is gone and it's dried up, they actually no longer have seeds either. And you'll see this in verse 11. So now we see who he's spoken to. Now he adds one more. He says, despair, you farmers. Those are tillers of the soil. Despair, you farmers. Wail, you vine growers. Grieve for the grain and barley, for the wheat and barley. And again, this is a statement about the failure of all of the crops that they have, because the harvest is destroyed. The vine is dried up, the fig tree is withered, the pomegranate, the palm, the apple, this term, this could also mean apricot. All of the trees or fields are dried up. And then he comes with a thing, surely the people's joy is withered away. And I guess I want to make just a quick analogy of where we are today. You know, we live in a land where we're like in the time of Amos, we're comfortable with our life. If you go back to February, we were comfortable with our life. We could go to the grocery and buy whatever we needed. We, you know, had jobs. We had, country was strong. The economy was strong. Our 401ks, our investments were strong. We had a bright future in front of us. We looked at everything as though we were being blessed by God. We didn't need to depend on God because things were going so well. And then what happened? A virus hit and everything changed. And so I want to relate that here, because the Jews were doing fine. The land of Israel and Judah were doing fine before they got sacked by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians. But when they came like this swarm of locusts, and it was a natural plague. And I also want to say, God doesn't need an army to destroy us. You know, we worry about nuclear war. We worry about the Russians. We worry about the Chinese. We worry about, you know, an EMP bomb. We worry about all those things. And certainly they are boogeymen out in the fringes for us to worry about. But God doesn't need those. God with a virus, God with a plague, God can do, bring us to our knees in very short order. I mean, look at where we are today. And this is the situation for Israel at this time where this plague has come through. And surely the joy of the people is withered away. I mean, we talked about this last week. You know, people are depressed. People don't see a future. People are worried. And one of the great challenges we have as Christians is to share the gospel, because through the gospel, we have the joy of the Lord. We have the hope of the future. We have all of the things that give us hope despite our circumstances. But see, this is before the cross. This is the time when they didn't have that hope in the Lord, and they weren't dependent on the Lord. So he's saying, surely their joy is withered away. And that's kind of a warning, both for them and for us. I think it's important to stress that point. Then he goes on to say, alas for that day, for the day of the Lord is near. Now I want to talk about that for just a second. The little book I had, and I'll hold it up again. It's called Joel, The Day of the Lord. It's a book written by the guy named David Levy, who's one of the editors for the Friends of Israel. They write some very good books, as I mentioned before. Some of them are a little bit technical because most of them are Messianic Jews and they write from a Jewish perspective, but they're wonderful little books. And anyway, he thinks this whole book is about the day of the Lord, and it is. It's also about some other things, but the day of the Lord we've talked about before. The day of the Lord is a phrase in the Hebrew and also in the Greek New Testament that covers multiple things. I want to tell you what it's covering here. We think today of the day of the Lord being the tribulation period, the seven-year period that will come after the rapture of the church. And certainly it is that. The final day of the Lord is the day when Jesus comes back for his second coming to judge the world. That's the 24-hour day of the Lord. But the day of the Lord in the Old Testament was used differently, and it really means any time that God steps in and intervenes in the affairs of man. And so what he's saying is, alas for that day, for the day of the Lord is near. In other words, God is about to step in to our lives, and generally the day of the Lord is not pleasant. It's the day of the Lord because God is punishing or disciplining Israel for what they've done. And it's always the wrath of God comes. And usually it comes by way of an army. And here it comes by way of insects. Perhaps today it's coming by way of plague. Plagues were also big back in the Old Testament and New Testament as well. So I don't want to ignore that fact. But the day of the Lord is here. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Now, let me just say the Almighty here, capital A, is the term El Shaddai. El Shaddai means God Almighty, the God of all power, the God of all everything. So he's saying it will come like destruction from El Shaddai. And so that really puts the point on the pencil that says this will become because God is calling the day of the Lord down on us. And then he says in verse 16, I've highlighted one little verse here. Has not the food been cut off before our very eyes? I want to say, what are we looking at today? What is before our very eyes? You know, are we going to tell our children, our grandchildren? Some of them are seeing it now, but we are watching in front of our very eyes our civilization being taken apart piece by piece. Now, some of it is because of the COVID. Some of it is because of the anarchy that's going on and all the things that people are using that as an excuse to try to make social change. But we're watching all of that before our very eyes. And joy and gladness also has been cut off from the house of God. Think about for a minute, you know, we can go protest and it's fine, but we can't go to church and sing in so many places today. Are we as a culture cutting off the joy and gladness from the house of God? Is that being cut off for us? I can't help but think about the churches that are sort of refusing to come back on campus. You know, we're coming back on campus and we're doing it in a very responsible way. We're social distancing. People are wearing masks. We're not, you know, willy-nilly putting 5,000 people in a room. We're doing that as the medical people advise us. But we are also fully aware that we are citizens of heaven and God is our ultimate protector. It's not government. And so we are fully cognizant of both of those. And I'll just call to mind that John MacArthur, who you know is a pastor on the West Coast, is basically fed up with what's going on in California. You know, they can protest all they want, but they can't go to church and they can't sing. And they're threatening to arrest people. And MacArthur has basically said, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to come and sing and we're going to come and worship. And they had a full service last week. And of course, now the government is threatening to cut off their electricity and water, you know, to try to stop them from worshiping. And it's going to be interesting how that plays out because MacArthur is not one to back down. He senses that this is what God wants him to do. And he's going to step out and stand with the shield of faith and the helmet of salvation and face this enemy. And it's going to be interesting to watch that. We ought to pray for those congregations that are doing that, because it is a powerful statement that we understand the government is not our savior and that we lean to a higher power, and our higher power is who governs our lives and what we do. Then he goes on and says, the seeds are shriveled beneath the clods. Clods is a word that's kind of intranslatable. So the NIV uses clods, but what you can interpret that is, even the seeds, the things, seeds they've planted aren't going to grow because they don't get any moisture and they're just shriveled up and beyond repair. The storehouses are in ruins. So the places where they've stored grains, the granaries have been broken down. People have probably taken it all and the grain that's left is all dried up. And so all of that creates a problem, not just for them, but for their herds of cattle. It says how the cattle moan. The herds mill about because they have no pasture. So you can just picture cattle that are gaunt. They've got nothing to eat. They're eating stems of wood. They're eating leaves that are dried on the ground. They're eating whatever they can find. And even the sheep, who can basically find something to eat almost anywhere, are suffering. So this tells you of the destruction and also it tells you that nature itself is groaning under God's judgment. And we see nature today groaning under God's judgment. We see all of these events happening that are part of the signs of the times. And I'm sure that the pastor will talk about that today. We talked about it in some of the little sessions we had, the In Case You Missed It sessions, or the couple of times I've done Signs of the Times lessons. We see that stuff happening today. Nature is groaning. Earthquakes are happening. Volcanoes are erupting. You know, ice is melting. We have all sorts of things happening because nature is under attack by what's happening in the world. And then he says, what are we going to do about it? He says, to you, Lord, I call. So he's called all these people to attention in the land, and he's now given them an idea of what to do. To you, Lord, I call, for fire has destroyed the pastures in the wilderness, and flames have burned up all the trees of the field. Even the wild animals pant for you. So again, pant is something an animal does when they need water, need nourishment. The streams of water have dried up. The fire has devoured the pastures in the wilderness. So not just the cultivated, but the uncultivated things are dried up. So he's making a call to God. Now, what is he going to ask for? Let me go back here. Is that 20? Okay, so that's the end of this chapter. I didn't realize I'd come to it so quick. But let me just get to my notes here. Like typical, I get tied up in this and I don't read my notes. So give me just a second to get to the last page of my notes because there's something I wanted to say here. The day of the Lord is a little different than what we saw in Philippians. We saw in Philippians, Paul mentioned the day of Christ. The day of Christ is a time of joy. The day of the Lord is a time of judgment. And so he's calling on them and giving them an idea of what to do. And let me just look here. In the second chapter, we're going to see exactly what he's asking them to do. So what I would say to you this week, let me summarize a couple of things here, and we'll go on. So in chapter one, Joel is using this insect plague to show the people that God can use nature to utterly destroy them. I mean, that's a message we've gotten pretty clear in the last 3 months ourselves. There's a lot of things we worry about. Some of them we should worry about. And some of them, you know, we don't worry about some other things that God can do. So they were smug in their positions of wealth before the Lord, as we saw in Amos. And today that really tells us where we are. You know, we've got technology, we've got armies, we've got prosperity, we've got wealth, we've got a land of milk and honey, we've got everything we need. And we just had a slight shadow during this plague. I mean, while death is terrible and however many people have died, you know, if it's 140,000, I don't know what the number is now, you know, a number of those probably died with COVID and not of COVID. A lot of those deaths would have happened anyway. But even regardless of that, that number is a small number to the 330 million people that are here. Yet this plague has taken on a biblical proportion to us. But God doesn't need that to bring us to our knees. God can bring us to our knees with the simple forces of nature. And that is important because Israel is a strong nation today. You know, Israel is the number eighth most powerful nation in the world with its armies and technologies. I would say it's actually higher than that because they have nuclear weapons. They have all the weapons that we've given them. The U.S. is in the same condition. And God can pull not just on Israel, but on the U.S. He can show us a way to bring us to our knees very quickly. So in chapter one, Joel sets the stage for what he's going to do in chapters two and three. Chapter two, he moves from this immediate plague to an imminent problem for them. And I'll just give you a little 30-second highlight. The difference in immediate is, you know, immediate is what's happening now. Imminent is something that could happen anytime. Like we say, the rapture is imminent. That doesn't mean it's going to happen today, but it could happen today because there's nothing standing between it happening and where we are today. And what he's speaking of as the imminent problem for them is the destruction coming by the Assyrians when the northern kingdom is hauled off, or if you want to say even for Judah, when the Babylonians come and they're hauled off. Now, this is 100 years earlier than that, or 75 years earlier than that. So we see that it is an imminent problem. And then in chapter 3, he will go on to talk about the mountain you see. Once you get to the place you're going, you see a higher mountain even beyond. So that will kind of cover for that. So we're going to finish a little early today. I wasn't sure how long this would take. So if you haven't read the book of Joel, read it. I would say read it in a modern translation. And I don't want you to get hung up in, you know, things like what a Palmer worm is, or, you know, whether one insect chews and one bites, or anything of that kind of stuff. Look at the bigger picture, because that's what Joel is trying to tell us. So read all three chapters. I'll have updated news on our August return to campus. I'll send that out probably in a note this week as soon as I get clarification. As I've said before, I'm trying to get us back on campus the 16th at some meeting place. I don't know where, but I'll let you know. I'm also asking for one separate evening other than Sunday night would be okay, but any night that we can get together for about 2 hours, because I want to do that DVD that I mentioned called Beyond the Wrath. That is a DVD about the wedding ceremonies in Judaism. And it's such a critical thing for you to understand that before Pastor Jeff gets to the series on the rapture and the second coming, because it places what the New Testament says to us in a completely, I won't say completely different, but it places it in a very bright light that gives us real clarity on what he's trying to tell us. And I would say, you know, pray for each other as we did earlier. We've got some surgeries coming up. We've got people that are in pretty dire straits in hospitals right now. Pray for the healing hand of the Lord. I would also say, go to people you know who need the Lord and make an effort to get them to watch Pastor Jeff if they can, because that will give, that hopefully will heighten their urgency of living for the Lord and getting to know the Lord and getting that relationship with him as we come to this this period in our nation and in the nation, in the history of the world. And pray for him, because he's going to need that as he goes forward. Encourage him. Send him notes of encouragement. Thank him. Do all the things to lift him up during this time. Pray for him. Send your new prayer requests, as Royce mentioned, to Don Driggers. He'll be back on Tuesday. And if I can help you, if you want clarity on anything, or at least my version of clarity, contact me either by phone or by email or however you want to do it, and we'll do it. Early voting is in place in some counties. I would suggest you do it. They've had, I think, a week or 2 weeks of it now in Dawson County, and it's going fairly well. They have 60 to 80 people every day coming, and so that'll give them 500 or 600 people probably. They got 650 plus now, so they'll probably have 1,000 by the time this is done in Dawson County. I would urge you to get out there and do that. Also, my prayer for each of you is blessing for each of you individually and your families and your friends. And, you know, you are in my prayers, and I know our prayer warriors pray for each and every one of us every single day, especially those things that we lift up to everyone. And let me just say a prayer, and then I'm going to unmute and we'll talk for a second and then we'll dismiss. So let me just pray. Lord, I just come to you now and thank you for what you're doing in our lives. And Lord, I pray that we will wake up. I pray that we will come out of our sleepwalking and we will be aware of what you're doing in the world. And we'll be aware of what it means in terms of where we live in the timeline of history. Lord, I pray that we will take the action you call us to. We're all under a call from you, Lord, and I pray that we will do what you've asked us to do. We'll fulfill the thing you've called us to do and the people you've called us to be, and we will spread your word, and we will mention to others, and we will be counselors, and we will be those that are encouragers to others. Lord, I pray that we'll be the wisdom, the mind of wisdom, the mind of calmness in this time of chaos, and we'll bring people to understand that through you and through a relationship with you, they can have your peace and your joy, because they move from being just a citizen of Georgia or the USA, but they move into a new relationship where they're a citizen of your kingdom. And Lord, I pray that all of us understand that. Lord, I also pray that we remember during these times that we are your children. We are children of the light, and we are called to be better. And we are called to be taken out of here before the serious wrath from you comes. And Lord, I don't know when that is. I don't want to predict when that is. But Lord, it's much closer now than I've ever seen it in my life. And I just pray that we stay focused on doing what you've called us to do. Lord, I pray for the pastor as he comes and speaks your word. I pray that the word he speaks is the word you've given him, and that he speaks it with power and with the power of the Spirit and with the power you've given him, with clarity. And for each of us, with our own separate needs, it meets the need that we have in our heart. It gives us the little push, the little nudge, the little encouragement to be about your business. Lord, I pray that in the holy and blessed name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you all. I appreciate you being here. Let me free this up here for a second. Figure out how to do that again. So let me unmute. Can I do that? You'll have to unmute yourself. I don't see an unmute for everybody here. So anyway, that's it. I'm going to stop the meeting. I pray that you guys, some of you go today. If you don't go, be sure and watch the pastor, because I think this is a critical thing as we start this next few weeks to set the stage for everything he's going to do. So God bless each of you, and I will be in touch with you later this week.
Thank you,
Jim.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Praying for you in the morning.
Thank you. Yeah, Jan, you're in our prayers. Thank you.